Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute offers classes, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Civility, Civic Engagement, and More Maturity in Politics. And today's moderator will be John Kessler. John Kessler is a practicing attorney in Salt Lake City. He is serving as director of the Utah Civility and Community Initiative. The initiative is co-chaired by Utah Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell and Salt Lake Mayor Ralph Becker, with an advisory council of 40 individuals from every sector of Utah society. And with that, please welcome our guest and moderator, John Kessler.
Thank you very much, and we welcome you to this event. In January of 2010, the University of Utah received the Community Engagement Classification from the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching. This was a high honor among colleges and universities across the country. And given the tradition of engagement and this recognition, part of the inaugural week for David Pershing as the 15th president of the University of Utah is to dedicate today as Civic Engagement Day and have various opportunities around the campus for themes and topics and activities, as well as in the community, that reflect this theme. So we are grateful to the Hinckley Institute for welcoming us to a very special topic, and I think a very timely topic. Civic engagement presumes civility, and in turn, civility presumes inclusiveness and collaboration, working together to get things done, which ultimately is what politics is all about, getting things done in the public interest. And yet, as we've seen, this isn't happening as much as it should be, perhaps. And we felt that it would just be very appropriate, and the Hinckley Institute invited us to come here to invite a very distinguished panel of, in three cases, elected officials, and another case, somebody who works in the political process, to come address this issue about civility, civic engagement, and in this maturity theme. How can we develop a little bit more mature political process that is more willing to be inclusive, more willing to be collaborative, more willing to get things done? I'd like to briefly introduce our distinguished panel members. Three of the four of these individuals are on our advisory council for our Utah Civility and Community Initiative. So by definition, they were recognized as people who had a strong interest in this theme, not just on the political level, but from our schools and to every corner and aspect of our society here in Utah. From your right, going left, we have Utah State Senator Curtis Bramble, who's recognized as being outspoken and firm in his beliefs, but at the same time really understands the deeper essence of the importance of, in appropriate ways at appropriate times, working towards collaborative possibilities for public policy and other things that are important to our society here in Utah. Next to Senator Bramble, we have Salt Lake County Mayor Peter Caroon, who, as most of you know, is a wonderful example of making an attempt to be inclusive and collaborative in efforts that he has been making on behalf of Salt Lake County for these past number of years. Next to Mayor Caroon is Kilo Zamora, the Executive Director of the Inclusion Center. And again, Kilo is a member of our advisory council for Utah Civility and Community. And the nature of his organization, you know, in its very name, is to be inclusive. And he'll bring the perspective as opposed to the other panel members who are elected officials here in Utah of somebody who works with that sense of collusion, inclusion, and gets engaged in the political process in that way. Then to Mr. Zamora's left is Midvale Mayor Joanne Seguini. And Mayor Seguini has been known statewide for many, many years, really going into decades, of a visionary mayor who has just pioneered ways to get the full community involved in conversation around issues that are important, encouraging that civic engagement and finding ways to make that happen and be more effective as a community in that manner. We've asked each of our panel members to take about 5 minutes to talk about their sense of this, the importance of civility and engagement and a more mature, inclusive political process from their perspective. And then we'll have a conversation among panel members, and we'll also field questions from the audience. So why don't we just start in the same order, moving from right to left, beginning with State Senator Curtis Bramble.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation. When you talk about civility, there's some misperceptions. And one of those is you can be passionate. I enjoy the introduction, outspoken. I guess that means that when I pursue a policy issue, I'll speak plainly and explain exactly where I'm at on the issue. But that doesn't mean that you don't have to engage in civil dialogue with folks that have a different perspective. If you can attribute to the folks on the other side of an issue, and it's not always the other side of the aisle, as we've seen during the mayoral campaign here in Salt Lake County to replace Mayor Caroon, one of my colleagues, a very conservative Republican from St. George, has actively endorsed our colleague, Senator Ben McAdams, a Democrat. So you've got a Republican endorsing a Democrat. They don't always see eye to eye on their votes in the Senate, but they work very well together. And so confusing civility with emotion or passion or speaking directly, sometimes we get those confused. But if you can attribute to the folks on the other side of an issue the same passion, the same sincerity, the same conviction that you hold yourself for your point of view, you don't have to demagogue, you don't have to demonize, you don't have to call someone a socialist or a fascist or that they have an ulterior motive or that there are other things that are going on, you can take the issue on its face. And a good example of that, during the 2011 legislative session, we engaged in a dialogue on immigration. Third rail of politics at the state, national level, you shouldn't take that on. And yet we came together as a state and found a way to set our partisanship aside and be Americans first and look at a challenging problem and come up with a solution that if you look at the voting record on that bill, House Bill 116, you'll find it had strong bipartisan support, even though on both sides of the aisle and in both core constituencies, there was some real concern, there was some animosity, there was some pushback. But as representatives of the people, we were able to find a way to engage in dialogue. If politics is the art of compromise, that means when you sit down, you won't get everything out of the negotiation that you'd like. But hopefully you'll get enough out of that negotiation that you're better off coming together than continuing to oppose. And I think that's a big part of the civility. I think another component, and I don't know, have a clock here, so let me know when we're 5 minutes. Respect. If I know Peter Kroon and I don't agree on some philosophic underpinnings of government. I know that because we've had the discussions. And yet we've come together more than once and have been successful in teaming up on policy here in the state. And that's born out of respect and confidence that Peter is a man of integrity. I may disagree, but we can do so respectfully. And through that disagreement, we can find common ground. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for those kind words, first of all. and it's great to be here up at the university. I was thinking about civility in politics, and first thing I thought was that's probably an oxymoron, civility in politics, but it's not. But sometimes during election seasons, we always say, oh, gosh, this is the worst and meanest election I've seen ever. And it seems like, you know, the next 2 years later, we're saying the same thing. So I decided to do a little research and look back into history about civility in politics. And this is what I found. First of all, in my own campaigns, I've always, except with one exception, I've always become pretty good friends with the people I've run against. So you know, if you spend 9 months battling each other out in the political arena, usually you end up becoming friends versus enemies. But as looking back, I found a few things. First, in 1981, during the second inauguration of Scott Matheson, he noted that there was a meanness in spirit, or of spirit, that had infected the public debate. And then if you look back even further, in the 1800s, the presidential contest between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson was considered one of the meanest presidential elections in history. I'm not sure if we're not seeing another one that's a little bit mean these days. And then as a teenager, George Washington transcribed from French to English a book called The 110 Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation. So even in George Washington days, they were talking about civility and conversation. Of course, the BYU-Utah game probably would have been an exception to that civility. And then just recently, after the shooting of Gabrielle Giffords, former presidents George H.W. Bush and President Clinton came together to start a national institute to promote civility in political discourse. So, you know, sometimes we think things are mean, but sometimes maybe they've always been a little bit mean and tough in politics. But as Senator Bramble said, sometimes we confuse a good, healthy, spirited conversation with meanness, and they're not always the same. There is a way to be tough and forceful in your position without being uncivil or calling people names, and I think that's what we try to achieve. Sometimes we do it well, sometimes we stumble and fall and make mistakes, but I think for the most part, you know, civility can come in waves, and it seems like there's certain times where people get a little bit more civil, and then certain elections they get a little bit uncivil, but I think over time we've had our ups and downs in civility in politics.
Well, it's an honor to be here, and it's an honor to be amongst these three panelists who have a lot more experience in the inside ring of politics than I ever will, because I've never been elected. But I am working from the outside, and there is something to be said about the way civility works when you're trying to pass something forward that hasn't been passed before. On some level, you can, if you don't push hard enough, some folks think that you're watered down in your ability to move an issue forward. If you push too hard, the doors seem to be closed when you're working with senators and statesmen and mayors and CEOs. So you play a very fine line of temperament of moving something into an arena where it's going to get passed. And I have found that temperament is a challenge because oftentimes in my work, which is about bringing disenfranchised communities into a place of equity, it's hard to find a place at the table for them. And when you call out a group that hasn't brought a place at the table for them, there's an automatic feeling of threat. So where do you go with that when there's already a feeling of threat from both sides? One that feels like they haven't got enough of the pie, and the other who's being called out for not giving them enough of the pie. And somewhere in that conversation, civility must happen or nothing moves forward. So I found when you can sit down with political leaders and find their humanity, there's a lot to be done. And I feel like you don't get everything you want. And if you think you're going to go in it and get everything you want, you're going to be really surprised because there's compromise involved. And when you walk out, everyone should feel like they got a little bit out of the deal. But that can be a challenge when you go back to your constituents and share how you made a difference, but you didn't make all the difference they were looking for. And so some folks feel like civility may not be the right direction. But I have to tell you, being an activist in our community, civility is the number one tool that I use. But I have to use it strategically too. Because I have to not just be polite, but I have to be polite with some strategy as well. Because I want to get something done in our community. And sometimes just smiling doesn't get it done. But at the same time, I have to be passionate about what I believe in. And know that the person across the aisle is doing the same thing. But at the end of the day, I got to find a way to shake their hand, ask about their family, and make sure that I treat them with the dignity they deserve.
To me, the key to civility is learning how to listen. Frequently, as all of us have expressed, we will come to a table and there will be differences of opinion, maybe strong differences. But one of the problems that we have as a nation is that we don't listen to each other. We wait our turn. We're really good at that. But we don't listen. We don't really take time to hear what the other person is saying and to clearly interpret their point of view. It may not change yours. But if you're not a listener, then you don't even know what both sides of the argument might happen to be. I have found in a variety of settings with a large Latino community in my own city, with people who are having concerns about building permits being issued for high-density housing, that all the things that present the kinds of things that happen in a community, not in government necessarily, but in a community. How do you get people to understand the point of view of others and the needs of the community at large? Well, you have to listen to each other. When I start out council meeting, I always say, a public hearing, for example. I think in government we're wonderful for having public hearings in which we invite the public and we don't care what they say. We're going to do it anyway. That's just wrong. So I always tell people in a public hearing that everybody will speak. Everybody that wants to speak may speak. They're not going to be timed. They can say anything they want to say. If they are rude and are using inappropriate language, they'll be asked to leave. But other than that, they can say anything they want to say. And I realize in a public hearing, for example, that a lot of the people are there and they have very strong feelings, but they'll never stand up. They'll sit in the back, poke each other, and say, they'll never stand up. So what I do is I say, Mr. So-and-so just presented this point of view. Will you raise your hand if you agree? So everybody is participating in the discussion. And you can't please everybody, but you have to include everybody. Inclusion is critical. That's part of civility. And you can't do it if you've already made up your mind and you're not going to listen to anything. And I'll take it even a step further. We are not civil within our families. We don't listen to each other. If you start at home, it becomes easier in the bigger marketplace. Listening is the key.
Thank you so much. We'd like to involve the audience as much as you would like to be involved in questions of individual panel members or of the entire panel. So I'll look for hands coming up, and short of that, I'll just facilitate, moderate a discussion among panel members. All right, just to begin with, this is really to any of the panel members and hopefully several of you. Are there any examples that you have seen or that you think would be helpful to increase the, you might say, the medium level of civility? Mayor Caroon talked about how things go in cycles. You have a lot of civility when people are shocked by the lack of it, and then it kind of decreases again. But are there some things that we can do in our communities or even in our political institutions that would be practical next steps that you think would be helpful that aren't really happening now as much as you think they should? Mayor Caroon.
I think one of the things that you can do to increase civility is getting to know the people on the other side of the aisle. whatever the issue is. It's a lot harder to criticize somebody you know than somebody you don't know. And so if there's an issue that's out there, whether it has to do with dogs in parks or whatever the issue might be, and I bring that up because it is one of the passionate issues that tends to arise, if you get to know the people on the other side of the aisle, it usually brings the noise level down and brings the inclusion and collaboration level up. So I think listening and getting to know the people on the other side of the issue is important.
Thank you.
Another thing that I've learned is that, particularly inclusion, when you have groups that have not been included, that have hidden themselves, and I would say many of the Latino communities, people have not been involved in politics. You've got to know that their involvement comes with conditions. For example, if you invite them to come someplace and do something, they will always bring their children. They never leave them with a babysitter. So you have to plan for their inclusion to have some place where their children can go and be supervised during the meeting. I once had our council chamber full of our Latino citizens who were coming to ask for $200 in CDBG fund to continue a community outreach program. And as I tell them, there's so many of you, you can't be invisible. You better be part of the solution. And they are becoming part of the solution. But my job was to understand under which conditions they could participate. And I think that's clue of anything that we do, whether I'm working with the legislature, whether I'm working with the county, whether I'm working with independent groups about issues or problems. I need to know the kind of conditions that are there before I start the conversation. What facts do they need? What time considerations do I have? You've got to put all that in place, or you are not going to be civil because you don't know the rules on either side. And you have to know the rules.
Thank you, Mayor Seguini. Senator Bramble.
Well, as I'm reflecting on civility, we have two mayors, executive branch of government. You make decisions, and your decisions are carried out by the executive branch, generally speaking. In the legislature, it's a little bit different. There's a rule of 38, 15, and 1. It takes 38 votes in the House, 15 in the Senate, and the governor's signature. And with community activists, it's even a little bit different. But I think one thing that Mayor Kroon said, if you can get to know folks, it's hard to demonize. In the legislature, in the Utah Senate, I'll speak from my own experience, every year we have a president's dinner. It's not a Republican dinner, a Democrat dinner. And throughout the year, there are activities that both Republicans and Democrats, the entire Senate, engages in. And that social side of the legislature, sometimes we get beat up in the media because someone hosted a dinner. Well, those opportunities to interact and engage in dialogue outside of the heat of battle on the floor of the Senate is something that facilitates and fosters a far more civil environment. In Washington, D.C., that used to be the case. If you look at Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, staunchly liberal Democrat. Ronald Reagan, President of the United States, a staunchly conservative Republican. They were best of friends. If you look at Orrin Hatch and Senator Kennedy, they were best of friends, but those friendships weren't forged only in the heat of battle as they were dueling with each other in all those cases over a question of policy. But those friendships and getting to know each other were forged over years of engaging both on the field of play and in other areas of their lives, and I think that's important. That's a little different than the civility that is required when folks are coming before a government body and advocating and pushing for a particular point of view. I think one thing's important. I've been married 35 years. I love and respect my wife, and there are many times when either she or I, while we respect each other, we respectfully disagree. And I think that's something that needs to be thrown into this mix as well.
Thank you. Yes. You could state your name and indicate if your question is for any particular panel member or...
Just for the whole panel.
Okay.
Can you hear me? My name is Ellie Barker, and I'm a senior in political science and argumentation. And my question is just with, I want to get into politics, and that's ultimately my career goal, not to run, but necessarily, but...
Are you nuts?
In law and politics. But I think I see a lot of my peers kind of recoiling with the, you know, animosity and demonization and polarization in politics today. And how do we, as people, as someone who loves politics and likes to be engaged that way, how do we engage those people and bring people back into politics, which is such an important part of people's lives? I mean, it's our government. So how do you think we can engage those people?
I'll start again.
Mayor Caroon?
It's hard because it seems like people are so busy with their own lives that they become disengaged from the political system, especially on the local level. It seems like people are less and less engaged unless there's a big issue that affects them personally. Otherwise, people tend not to read the newspapers anymore. They tend not to watch the news on TV. A lot of times people are getting their news from the internet, and we're not sure, you know, how accurate that news is. So people either are disengaged or the information they're getting is not very accurate. What we've tried to do, and with some success and not so much success sometimes, is to bring myself to the people or open myself up to the people. So I've had open door meetings in our county where we try to get citizens to come and speak. And I say I usually get three kinds of people: those that want something, or need something; those that trying to sell me something; and those people who are just lonely and want to talk to somebody. So. We also had town hall meetings out in the community, and so trying to engage people in the issues that are important to them. And I know Salt Lake City has done this, and we're trying to do it now, having these open dialogues via the internet, since that's the way people like to communicate these days. And so putting questions out on the internet to citizens and asking them to respond, or, you know, using Facebook and social media. So trying to bring government to the people instead of expecting people to come to the government, because they generally won't unless there's an issue that really affects their lives.
No, which one am I, Peter? Because I see you all the time in the community.
You're the lonely one.
Okay, Kilo.
You know, it's a great question about recoiling. When I'm testifying up on the Hill and a lawmaker is using their phone and not listening to my testimony, it drives me crazy, and I walk out of there with a bad taste in my mouth. Like, what was the point of me being there in the first place? And I think we can have those experiences. Really, specifically, it's more difficult when it's something you're really passionate about and you feel like the stakes are high, but the lawmakers aren't listening. But the flip side of that is when you continue to see lawmakers in the community all the time, and they're finding ways to engage you. And I can think of a couple of interesting ones. I helped Salt Lake City run their dialogues by zip codes to help pass the anti-discrimination ordinance in the city. And it was a brilliant model. And what we did is we took every zip code in Salt Lake City and we went to that zip code and ran the dialogue there. Each dialogue was a little different, a little different topic. But we brought it to the people. And we asked those questions to the people. And they engaged. And people saw that process all the way through. And not only did they see it all the way through, but, you know, it led to a wonderful piece of a wonderful law being passed in our city to see that there's not discrimination occurring and we're having a more inclusive process. But then it went another step further, and I'm thinking about Chris Butters and Ben McAdams joining together in our Utah law to see that happen on a state level. And I really think that when we have those kind of examples of when we saw a process work and we engaged from the grassroots up, it's hard not to be enchanted by what wonders come out of democracy. But I really think that if we can't get these messages to the people and have them be engaged in the full process, why wouldn't we recoil? Because we're not being heard. So I think it plays both ways, and it takes young, passionate minds to not give up and re-engage our community and get passionate folks like the folks are around this table up here to get them in the community and listen and find ways to engage over and over again. I cannot see a better process happening. The internet's part of the solution, seeing social media work to our advantage. But you know, there's nothing like a good old-fashioned conversation. There's nothing like getting in interacting with human beings on a daily basis. And it changes everything about the way it works. And that's the neat part about being in local politics, is that you get more opportunity to do that, and we got to create more chances to see young students getting there, working with our lawmakers and our policymakers, and let them touch and feel these folks, because they're human beings. And they, too, are, you know, enjoying and tired and sick and going through all kinds of life, and it's messy and funky, and it's not deodorized like you see on the national scale. There's a few sound bites here and there. So I think you got to be willing to go there and bring it to the people as much as you can.
I'm going to weigh in a little bit differently. A couple of years ago, I had the opportunity to travel to Iraq to work with the newly elected Baghdad Provincial Council and members of the National Parliament. There were about 28 Iraqi elected officials that were at this seminar, and I was the sole presenter. I was there for about 10 days. Five of the positions, the elected positions, the original candidates had been assassinated, and the folks that were elected were the replacement candidates. Those folks took involvement in government and trying to find self-determination and trying to build a representative form of democracy. They took it pretty seriously. Here in America, it's easy to disengage. It's easy to say, let someone else do it. Winston Churchill was reputed to say that the American form of government, and those of you that are political science majors, you'll be able to find this quote, and I'll probably butcher it, paraphrasing it, but he basically said during World War II that the American form of representative democracy was the worst form of government ever devised by man, until you consider all the others. And if you think about that, if you want to step up and make a difference, all you have to do is look at the situation worldwide, or better yet, talk to our brave men and women that wear the uniform, that are putting it all on the line to protect the very ability, the very freedom you have to graduate and engage in politics, or the friends of yours that are disengaging, in a realization that if we want to make this place better, this our state, our community, our nation, our neighborhood, that it takes stepping up, and it takes a little bit of work, and sometimes it takes a bit of dedication. The easiest thing to do is to check out. It's far more difficult to step up and have your voice counted. In my case, I didn't like what was happening with our state tax law, not the tax rate or some of the things you may consider, but the administration of our tax laws was such that citizens had no Bill of Rights. There was no statute of limitations on collections. Citizens didn't know what to do when government was going to seize their assets, and I felt like it needed to change. And so I went out, found a few folks who would allow me to plant a yard sign, and got myself elected. And we have reformed our taxes over the last 12 years radically from what they were a decade or so ago. And so I'd encourage you to make the case that this is the only game in town. And if your friends want to make a difference, they need to have their voice heard.
And I would add to that, one of the things that's interesting to me as I look at our society is that we have lost service. Every community used to have service clubs. They were called Kiwanis, and they were called Rotary.
Lions.
Those clubs are all gone. Or they have a membership of 3 members that are still sort of struggling to keep going, particularly when you get out of the capital city. That's because we're not involved in service. The young lady had a question about how do we get past these awful ads that we see on television. Everybody's calling everybody everything. First of all, look around you and see where your help is needed. I can see many people in this room today that I know are involved with nonprofit corporations that save lives. You can look around and see if there is a group and you're interested in their goals and work with them for a while. Go to your local community and say, what can I do here? Do you have some committees that I could attend? Do you have community councils that I might be a member? They do. You don't need to start at the top to be elected to public office. You need to start at the bottom and find out what public office means. To me, it means listening. To me, it means service. To me, it means civility, no matter what. But if you'd come to me and say, I want to get involved in Midvale City, the first place I'd put you when an opening occurred is on the Planning Commission. There's more stuff that goes on in the Planning Commission than anything else in the city. By the time it gets to the council and the mayor, you know, all of the discussions are over. And Planning Commission meetings are very busy. People may not come to council meetings, but they're at Planning Commission. Because they're concerned about what you're building where and why can't I build there and what are the requirements. That's one of the best places in the world to train for politics. So wherever you live and whatever you're doing, you're in a position to make a commitment to a city or a county or a government agency. If you can get to the Planning Commission, even if you go as an observer, you'll learn a whole lot about what's going on in your community and what matters to people. But you've got to get involved, and you don't have to run an election campaign to do that. There are many ways that you can get involved in the community. And when you get involved with one group, that ties you to another group, and that builds your political base, not necessarily to win an election, but your ability to know what the base in the community is and how you might be effective. Not only are people elected to the legislature, but they have a lot of lobbyists. And those lobbyists are not voting on things, but they're keeping the legislators informed. So there's a lot of ways in which you can interact with your government without being elected. Political science is the science of community, not just politics.
Thank you. Hi. Question from the audience. State your name, please.
Luigi Garci. I'm a senior architecture student. Regarding our Congress and civility, our current Congress has become infamous for not getting work done and having that unwillingness to cooperate between each other and between the two different parties. Do you think that the stereotyping of both parties and their unwillingness and their willingness to get their political parties say have more intensity than the other ones be the reason why there is such unwillingness in the Congress right now to get bills passed? I'm talking about all the frequent filibusters going on right at the moment. And if so, and if not, what do you think is the reason that there is such unwillingness in the Congress at the moment?
Well, I'll take a stab at it, but I'll reflect on a discussion I had with a member of the minority party in the House. This legislator sits behind me at Cougar Stadium, at Lavelle Edwards Stadium, and last week, a week and a half ago, whenever the last game I was there, she said, you know, my Republican opponent is beating up on me because in his literature he claims that I'm voting 97% with the majority of the Democrat caucus. And that's a perception, because the reality is she was voting 96% with the majority of the Republican caucus. Because here in Utah, if you look at the votes, you'll find very seldom do you find issues that fall on partisan lines. Okay? We don't see that in Washington, and part of that goes back to the notion of building relations across the aisle and having the courage to be a statesman, not a partisan hack. And what we need at the state level, at the local level, but we need it desperately at the national level, is we need to return to statesmen, and I don't mean that in a gender sense, men and women who are willing to step up and be Americans first and set their partisan prejudices or agendas aside to come together. And I think your point is well taken. It's too bad we don't have a congressman up here to respond.
No, if I may. You know, Senator Bramble, you've had some really great ideas. I have to continue to say that. Like you, I really appreciate the way you've been bringing this conversation forward. And I think he's onto something. I just listened to an NPR report that talked about this very thing, that the relations in Congress have declined. And it's every decade they've been declining since the 70s. And the question is, you know, what's going on in politics, getting back to your question, about why we're not moving things forward? And I think you're right. I think the tragedy is in the relationships. They're not there. And I pulled up the Utah Foundation's 2012 Utah Priority Survey. And they basically do a survey of Utahns and ask them what they think are the top priorities for our state. And number 8 is right on to your question, partisan politics here locally, that folks in our community are asking, why are there such partisan politics? And I have to say that although it sounds very simplistic, that we need to continue to work on building those relationships. And those relationships are key to seeing things move forward. And Senator Bramble said something else too earlier, which keyed me into a really beautiful relationship I remember. He had talked about the relationship between Orrin Hatch and the late Ted Kennedy. And that was something to be noted. And I remember a piece of legislation that they were trying to move together, which is what keyed me out of the relationship in the first place, when they were working on the DREAM Act. And in early 2000, what they were trying to do across party lines is not just find a hot topic to work on, but one that both of them from their communities were saying, there is something going on with our young, undocumented immigrants in our community and how we engage them, and we need to find some policies to move us forward. And they call each other up and they talk and they work on this together. But the problem is when we take these issues home to our community, people think that you're voting too, one way or the other too much. And they're not looking into what we're trying to do, as Mayor Seguini said, looking at the science of community, not the science of politics. And I think we get in trouble sometimes because we get misled by putting a label of a certain group on it, if it's Republican or Democrat or liberal or conservative. And we don't take the time, like I know these three have, and I've had to make some really hard choices that didn't always fall within sight of the strict party lines that they're a part of.
And I think sometimes we're bipolar as citizens. We want Congress to work together, and you know they have a 10% approval rating now, and nobody seems to like them yet. When they try to work together, you know we get angry at them, like why aren't you taking my side, and why aren't you you know, calling the other people names, and we want it to look like more of a hockey match, yet we complain when it does. And so I think that's an issue. And one of the reasons, I think, is because the further away government is, the less people necessarily understand it. And my government, which is a local government, you know, I tell our folks, if we start fighting, they're going to throw the bums out and get rid of all of us. So not only will I lose, but you'll lose too, because people will just get rid of all of us and vote us all out. But it seems like the further away you go, the more we expect partisanship, and the more we don't want them to be partisan, you know, we react negatively if they're not defending our side vigorously and attacking the other side.
We have 5 more minutes, and we'll take one more question from the audience.
I'm John Bennion. I'm an alumnus of the U of many years ago. I heard another quote from Winston Churchill just the other night that I loved. He said, "Americans always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other options." I'd like to raise a question about why engagement is perhaps down as much as it is in far too many places, like the voting rate in Utah. I mean, it's just embarrassing. And why is it that people don't feel like they really have a significant voice? And it seems to me there are two issues that cause that attitude to some extent. One is the amount of money that goes into races, and at least the perception is that office holders are very much influenced in a skewed way by those who contribute a great deal to their campaigns. And they listen to them a lot more than they listen to ordinary people. And then the other is the gerrymandering that's been going on all over the country that has created so many sort of safe districts, whether they be Republican districts or Democratic districts, so that really the office holder doesn't have to listen very much to a broad spectrum of points of view because they're either in a highly Republican area or a highly Democratic area, and it's a lot easier to go back to Congress and be very partisan because they don't have to answer to a very broad spectrum of public opinion. And also on the issue of gerrymandering, often people, why should I vote? Because it's not in play. If I'm on the other side, there's no way that I'm going to get my person elected. I'm wondering how much of a problem you feel those two developments are, the gerrymandering that's been going on over the past many years and the amount of money that is just pouring in more all the time into political races.
I'd like to test an assumption if I could here.
Well, just a moment, please. Since we only have about 2 minutes less, a little less than 3 minutes, so we could have one panel member answer one question, one panel member answer the other question.
I'll take gerrymandering.
So, yes.
Because a lot has been said about gerrymandering. The Wall Street Journal, the worst gerrymandering that they'd ever seen dealing with the congressional districts here. If that was true, sir, there should have been a lawsuit. This year, the redistricting had one dissenting vote in the House and one dissenting vote in the Senate. Just one out of 104 legislators in both bodies. One senator, one member of the House. The way we did redistricting, it's very difficult here in Salt Lake City to gerrymander a Republican seat. It just won't happen. The demographics are such that you can't draw a state House or Senate seat in Salt Lake City that would give a Republican a reasonable chance based on the demographics. And in my district in Provo, it's virtually impossible to draw a seat that would favor a Democrat. That's simply a matter of how our communities are currently, the demographics of the communities. And so this argument about gerrymandering, we hear it. But I would respectfully test the assumption, because if that were true, and if it were the case, then why was there only one dissenting vote in each chamber?
Well, I wasn't referring to Utah specifically. I was referring to the country generally.
I understand. In Utah, we've come together, unanimously supported, passed an energy policy. We had everything from the Sierra Club to the heavy industrials come together on our state energy policy. We've passed redistricting with only two dissenting votes this year. We've come together on immigration, on a host of issues. And so I think the assumptions need to be tested about their validity as it relates to the politics here in Utah.
Is there any more time?
We have about 2 minutes.
Okay. I think one of the things that was mentioned was campaign funding. I'm very concerned about the impact of the Supreme Court decision that says corporations are people, too. I think that's one of the things that we are seeing in this election. The inflow of money from we don't know where is attempting to buy elected officials. And I think that's something as citizens we've got to question. I don't know how we go about questioning it, but I think we have to be careful because we shouldn't just vote for the person who has the most ads from the most donations from wherever they come. I think we have to even more closely at the individual.
Well, I'd like to thank this wonderful, distinguished panel for sharing their wisdom from many, many years of experience and service in our community and in our state. And a special thanks to all of you for coming today. So many students here at the University of Utah, who I think you're here because you realize this is such a serious issue, and you really carry the possibility of transcending something that hasn't been transcended before by your passion and your involvement. And for those others of you of the community who've attended, we're so grateful for your attendance. And particularly to the Hinckley Institute of Politics, thank you so much on this very special Civic Engagement Day.